Hey, everybody. Welcome to another very special episode of the Brundlecast. I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. E. Michael Jones. Dr. Cynthia McKinney will be joining us shortly. I'm joined tonight by my co-host, Vivian Veritas. So, Dr. Jones, we were just talking offline a little bit about how you were introduced to the topic of Jews, and you were telling me that Luke Ford, someone that both myself and Vivian have been associated with, was somebody that introduced you to that topic. Can you give us a little bit of the history of how he influenced you, some of your other influences, and how that led to your seminal work, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit?
Well, this was around 2000 or so, maybe a little bit before that. I made contact with a rabbi. Rabbi Sam Dresner wrote a book called How Can the Family Survive in America, or something like that. And it was around the time that I started Culture Wars magazine. And he got a hold of a copy, and he liked what he saw. And we corresponded. I did a review of his book. And he would tell all the people he knew, especially the Catholics, to subscribe to the magazine because he liked what I was doing. His book that he wrote was kind of an eye opener for me because he attacked a lot of Jews in that book. Woody Allen was one, I remember. He was always attacking Jews for their penchant for sexual deviance and promoting sexual deviance. I remember very distinctly the chapter on Woody Allen. He did not like Woody Allen at all. He felt that Woody Allen was giving Jews a bad name. And generally, he felt that Hollywood was giving Jews a bad name. And so I guess that opened my mind. I was then at Chronicles magazine up in Rockford. I was there meeting in Tom Fleming's living room. He was the editor of Chronicles at that point. And Paul Gottfried was there. Paul Gottfried is a Jew. He was teaching at Elizabethtown College at the time. And he just laid into me and anyone who was listening, asking why we were all silent on the Jews. He was to get a chair, an endowed chair at Catholic University, and the neoconservatives, Norm Podoritz and that crowd, turned on Paul Gottfried and made sure he did not get that chair. And he had obviously he was annoyed at that thing. And he kept asking us, why don't you talk about Jews? How come I'm the only guy, he said to me, that talks about Jews? They play a big role, blah, 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 the whole thing. This was at around the same time that neoconservative had become part of everyone's vocabulary. Yeah. And it was around this time, a little bit after that, that America started to get sucked into a war in Iraq. That I remember watching it like a car wreck in slow motion. And I kept thinking, this can't be happening. This is preposterous. All the claims they're making are preposterous. It had nothing to do with the 9/11. This can't be happening. And then sure enough, it happened. And at this point, it was around this time. So that was 2003. And it was around this time that I made contact with Luke Ford.
Yeah.
Luke Ford's was a commentator on the pornography industry at that point.
An insider. He was doing some investigative journalism.
Yeah, he was doing a lot of research, I think. But at this point, he was, in a sense, doing what Paul Gottfried told me to do, because he was naming the Jews as being responsible for pornography. So at a certain point, all of these things came together in my mind, okay? And I realized I got to do something about this, because we are, as I said, the sense of this car wreck in slow motion kept going through my mind with the Iraq war. How were these people able to take over the foreign policy of the United States of America and involve us in a war where we had no business of being? How is this possible? And that's when I started doing the research for the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. And the first article I wrote was called Rabbi Dresner's Dilemma, So I dragged Rabbi Dresner and Ford, put him together with Luke Ford, and talked about Jewish involvement in pornography. That was the first article I did in that regard.
Awesome. That's great. I want to welcome Dr. Cynthia McKinney to the program. Thank you for joining us from the other side of the world. How are you doing, I guess, this morning for you, Cynthia?
Yes, it's morning for me, and my voice is not, I don't know what's going on. My
voice sound great to me.
Oh, well, I'm glad that I do. Okay, and it's an honor for me to even mediated by cyberspace, Dr. E. Michael Jones, whom I've just become familiar with, like literally maybe in the last 3 weeks or so, but I became so glued to what he was saying that I think I've now watched every video on YouTube in which he speaks. And of course, you combine what he has to say with the amount of research that he's done. I can't wait to get his books and actually delve into the books. Unfortunately, I'm so busy right now with my teaching schedule that I don't have much time to read them now, but I guarantee you that in my off time, in my downtime, I intend to search every footnote of Dr. Jones's books, because the subject matter, I believe, is critical to us being able to understand what has happened to the United States, the motivations of current U.S. foreign policy, and in particular, the wars. I like to consider myself the peace lady. And my single focus is how to stop the wars, and you can't stop the wars until you get an understanding of who benefits from those wars.
What is that understanding for you, Cynthia?
Well, my understanding is that we have both a sort of a political class and we have an ideological class who benefit from the wars. The ideological class are those people, I mean, they also benefit not only because it serves their ideology, but also because it serves their purpose. And I believe their purpose right now is, Jeff Gates puts it, that they are an intergenerational, multinational crime syndicate, a crime cabal or criminal mafia. And they now have state power, and they are able to wield state power. They have their own state power, but then they also operate through other states in coalition with the local elites of those states. So for example, you get a Macron in France who basically is the child of this marriage, this kind of marriage, or you get the situation in the United States where you have certain operatives from the deep state, the original owners of the state of the United States of America, and they have chosen to join with this criminal cabal rather than, and so they make money from the military machinery that's sold and all of that. So you have the marriage of this ideological bent with this financial incentive. And these people have left the rest of we, I believe that these yeah. people have left the rest of we the people behind.
So let me ask you just real quick, Cynthia, I mean, how has Dr. Jones's work impacted you in your understanding of these things? One thing that I think, because I actually also, I've been told for over a year now about Dr. E. Michael Jones's work. I really hadn't gotten around to watching it till the last couple months, but like you, I've kind of been binge watching. I can't get enough. It's a it's really a unique perspective. And I, maybe if you could reflect on what that, how that has contributed to your understanding of, you know, frankly, Jewish power and influence.
Well, you combine what he has so meticulously studied with my own personal experiences. So at one point I believed that Blacks and Jews had a destiny, that sort of a common destiny inside the United States. And that, well, that's sort of the line that we Blacks are told. And so then I began to look at the mechanisms by which certain Blacks are chosen for leadership positions, and they all seem to have to go through a sieve. And if you survive the sieving process, which includes a kind of loyalty to another country, then really the sky is the limit for you. And but if you don't survive that sieve, then basically there is no future for you in U.S. politics. This is what I, and not just the politics, but in sort of, you know, desirable social society. Yeah.
Getting a job.
Excuse me?
Like getting a job, holding a job, anything.
Yeah, well, perhaps not just any job, but say better jobs or good jobs, and jobs for which you are eminently qualified, but just never seem to get the call. And so I've been put through the sieve. And I see who the sieve shakers are. That's one part of what attracted me to Dr. Jones's research. But also the condition of the United States now. Of course, I come at it from a completely different vantage point because, as I said, I was first exposed of being a child of the South. I'm born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia. And during my early congressional campaigns, represented areas outside of Georgia, which took me into rural Georgia for really not specifically the first time in my life, but really to meet people, talk to people. It was the first time in my life to meet rural Georgians,
right,
and interact with them on a huge scale. And so what I began to understand is Melissa Faye Green, for example, wrote a book, The Temple Bombing, where her thesis was that the involvement, the Jewish involvement in the civil rights movement served the goals mostly of the Jewish community, not necessarily the Black community. And then I began to delve more and more into these questions. And then I eventually began to understand that there has been a lot of manipulation of the Black community that continues to this day. And so now, what is the real sort of U.S. national interest, or I shouldn't say national interest, what is the real U.S. state interest? And I'm the foreign policy person, so I look right there. And what I see is that we've deviated from U.S. state interests almost at every turn. And why? Because, as I was asked to do, sign a pledge from AIPAC. And basically that pledge was signing my allegiance over to whatever it was that was in Israel's interest, notwithstanding how it impacted the people that I was sworn to represent.
That was, by the way, Cynthia, it's a pleasure to be with you. It's an honor to be with you. But that incident you just referred to was one of the great iconic moments of modern politics, where you show up at your office. You haven't even been sworn in yet, and then the fax machine starts churning out a piece of paper that you're supposed to sign before you're even there. This was the zeitgeist of the past election. People woke up and they realized that they had two parties that represented the interests of the oligarchs and no party that represented the interests of people of Indiana. So you went to Congress and you thought you were going to represent the people of Georgia. And then the fax machine started to move and suddenly the whole different world opened up. It was one of those great moments.
Well, let me just make one clarification. And that is that the fax machine opened up before I got to Washington, D.C. And so by the time you get to Washington, D.C., you're already seasoned in that sauce. That is our problem, because it's almost veritably impossible to get to Washington, D.C. without being seasoned in that sauce.
Right.
That is our real problem. So now you've got people, you know, I see the stuff about the dual nationals, dual passport holders, and there have been some efforts in other countries to deal with that particular aspect. But basically, you don't get money in the U.S. political system unless you buy into that kind of sauce, that loyalty to another country. And so therefore it's very difficult to win. If you look at the 2018 midterm elections that just took place, how much of those winners, I've got so many questions about the 2018 election, but how many of them have already been baked in the sauce and they haven't even been sworn in yet? I would say veritably all of them that won.
Yeah. It was the same thing is true of Catholics. Rick Santorum was a classic example of what I'm talking about. He showed up at Notre Dame. He talked about how he had eight kids. So he's like Mr. Catholic with all those kids. But he had one tune and it was bomb, 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 bomb Iran. And the people of Pennsylvania got tired of it and they eventually voted him out of office. And he ended up working for the American Enterprise Institute. So, you know, no matter what you look like, you end up working for the people who run the show, and it turns out that it's the Israel lobby.
That's right. In fact, I have one experience where a professor who is a very prolific writer these days, his wife, I was under attack. His wife wrote a column in the local, I think upstate New York newspaper saying, you know, leave Cynthia alone. She's fine. You know, she's a good representative. She does well what it is that she does. Well, that professor was then told it's time for you to retire. So he became professor emeritus. And then I think his wife was retaliated against. And so then that professor decided that he would just start writing, exposing. And that professor has written several books now exposing. I think maybe one of them was actually, the name of it was Jewish Power in Washington or something like that. But so you literally have to toe the line. And if you deviate from the line in any way, then you get slapped down. This tolerance crowd is the most intolerant tolerance crowd I've ever seen.
Dr. Jones, let me ask you. So I think we've been talking about foreign policy and its role in Washington. Where does it seems like an issue in watching your videos? It's become clear to me that you perceive sort of what you call the Jewish revolutionary spirit. And please correct me if I'm wrong. But it's not, it is not confined just to, let's say, the Jewish religion or the Jewish people, but it's almost a force in the world where you see Protestantism being a Judaized religion. Maybe secularism is in this vein. Can you sort of expand on that and how that ties into what we've been talking about so far?
Yeah, you don't have to be Jewish to become a Jewish revolutionary. The Puritans were a Judaizing religious sect. They were revolutionaries. But in terms of what we're talking about now, the Black Jewish Alliance was a revolutionary movement. It got started beginning with the Leo Frank case. The Jews decided that they were going to get revenge on the South for lynching Leo Frank, and they created this revolutionary movement through things like the Anti-Defamation League, which got started as an anti-lynching operation. So you had the two brothers, I forget their name now, the two brothers anyway, started the NAACP, and it was created basically for Jewish interest. So Marcus Garvey shows up there in the 1920s, and he's walking around. There are no Black people. It's only Jewish lawyers. And the first job they have to do is to get rid of Marcus Garvey, who was a Black nationalist and didn't fit into the program of integration. So what you have is 70 years here of the Jews trying to turn the Black people in the South into the revolutionary avant-garde that is going to begin the revolution in the United States. And the culmination of this was, of course, the Civil Rights Movement. And at a certain point, the Blacks woke up to what was going on. The crucial turning point was 1967, with Harold Cruz writing The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, where he talks about his experience as a member of the Communist Party in Harlem, where basically everything that the Black people did in Harlem was to benefit the Jews and not the Black people. That combined with the Ocean Hill-Brownsville crisis and the Arab-Israeli war of that year basically destroyed the Black Jewish Alliance. It fell apart at that point. The Jews pulled out, and they tried to do something. They became Zionists at that point, more than devotees of the Civil Rights Movement. That has pretty much continued to this day, except for the efforts of George Soros to resurrect race war in the United States. But that was an example of the Jewish revolutionary spirit being imposed on a group of people that really were used by these people as proxy warriors. I mean, I personally grew up in a situation like this. Okay, I grew up in Philadelphia. I get into trouble because I say I'm biracial, you know, I'm Irish and German. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is that when in Philadelphia, we lived in an Irish neighborhood, okay? And then the black people crossed Lehigh Avenue, and then suddenly the neighborhood was gone. Everybody left. It was blockbusting. It was the whole thing. Now, I looked into this because it's the story of my life in a way. And it turns out that the book I wrote was The Slaughter of Cities, Urban Renewal as Ethnic Cleansing. So if you look at it superficially, okay, it's Black people crossing Lehigh Avenue and moving into a white neighborhood. But that's not really what was going on there, because what you had was the elites in Philadelphia basically trying to destroy Catholic political power by destroying these ethnic neighborhoods. So if you look into it, it turns out that who was bringing the Black people up from North Carolina? It was a Black minister by the name of Leon Sullivan, and he was working for John J. McCloy, who was the head of the Ford Foundation at that point. So when you take a step back, it turns out that this was a religious war, if you want to put it that way. Basically destroy Catholic political power, and the Blacks were being used, the Black people were being used as proxy warriors in that war.
Vivian, so, you have a question? Or no, Cynthia, go, so respond.
I have a question, and that is it really religious or is it really political? Because seem to be in pursuit of is political power. And whether it's political power inside the United States in order to enforce their policies on the rest of us, or if it is political power, say for another state like the state of Israel, so that then they can also have a safe haven that carries out their political slash ideological aims. So I'm wondering, is it more political and less religious? I don't really think it's religious.
Okay, I'm basing this on a sociological theory called the triple melting pot, which says there are three ethnic groups in the United States and they're based on three religions. So what they're saying is no matter where you come from, after three generations, you become either a Protestant, a Catholic, or a Jew. Those are the three ethnic groups in the United States. They're based on religions. The United States is in many ways like Yugoslavia in this regard. Okay, and the ethnic groups are in conflict with each other. That is the axis of political conflict in the United States. Now, the problem, if you're talking about political power, what these two of the groups realized, first of all, the WASP elite in the 1950s, right after World War II, they realized that the Catholic population was increasing. And they were concerned because the basis of political power is demographic power. So if you have a growing birth rate, there were two groups that had a growing birth rate at this time. It was the Blacks and the Catholics, okay? And they were perceived as a threat to the status quo. In Philadelphia, this came down to a group, the Americans for Democratic Action, which was basically an early kind of when Hubert Humphrey broke away from the communists and created the American left. This group was made up of Protestants and Jews, and they saw the Catholics as a threat because of demographic increase, and that's the way they decided to deal with them, by driving them out of their neighborhoods, dispersing them into the suburbs, where you started off Irish or Polish, and by the time you got to the suburbs, you were white, which means you had no ethnic coherence anymore.
Cynthia, what's been your experience with like the Jewish role in Black identity politics? I mean, you come out of the Democrat Party, you were in a majority Black district. Did Jews try to sort of run your organizations, run your campaigns?
So, I'm trying to. I want if Dr. Jones could send me sort of the citation for that, because I want to process that, because either you're Protestant, Catholic, or Jewish if you're white. So then there must be a different set of rules if you're not white, and a different set of contentions. The idea of the Black community becoming sort of cannon fodder in that larger struggle, I can understand that, and I basically agree with that, because it seems that the agendas that have been set have not been set Blacks for themselves. Even if you look at 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision, which is hailed as progress for the United States and progress for Black people, but an interview revealed to me that an interview that I recently became aware of revealed to me that the goal was changed, that the goal of the original legal efforts was just to prevent the Black kids from having to pass by white schools in order to get to the Black school that was not on their same side of town. And the white kids were, you know, had buses and that sort of thing, and the Blacks didn't. The Blacks were walking. So what started out as a process of equalization ended up as a process of desegregation, which was quite different. And one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit said that if desegregation had been the objective, then the process by which the desegregation would have been attacked legally would have been far different than what actually happened. So it seems that this might have been, even Brown versus the Board of Education, might have been yet another example of this kind of manipulation that I'm now learning about.
It was clearly an example. Read Murray Friedman's book on the collapse of the Black Jewish Alliance. He talks about Brown versus school board. All of the authorities were Jewish. All of the authorities were promoted, came from basically the American Jewish Committee. They were setting up the black people as proxy warriors for their agenda at that point. But the best example I can give of where this became apparent was when Martin Luther King went to Chicago. Dorothy Tillman was one of his lieutenants, and she said, she had this famous line. She said, "Down south, you was either black or white. You wasn't none of this Polish or Irish or any of that kind of stuff." So what you had in Chicago was a completely different situation. Okay, there was no segregation in Chicago. There were ethnic neighborhoods in Chicago. So why is Martin Luther King going to Chicago? Well, it's very simple. Nelson Rockefeller paid him $25,000 to go there. And also the Quakers had been trying to get him to go there ever since the early 1950s, ever since he made a name for himself. Now, what was he doing there? Well, he marched into Marquette Park and he got out of his car and people started throwing rocks at him. Now, were these white people in Marquette Park? If you asked them, they would have told you that they were Lithuanians, because all of Chicago was these ethnic neighborhoods. And here is King, Martin Luther King, being dragooned into a fight against the Catholics. He's brought into Chicago to bust up Catholic neighborhoods. And I don't think he ever understood that.
Let me just go further and say that it was not until there's a young man who's done some pretty impressive research on sort of the history of this manipulation. And this is a narrative, this is a history, this is a series of facts that the black community has no idea about whatsoever. And so there's a huge, tremendous education that needs to be held to tell this story to the black community and warn the black community about being used in somebody as cannon fodder in somebody else's war. So when I was in the Congress, one of the things that there were sort of impartial bystanders who were watching the war in the Democratic Party that was going on at that time. And the war at that time was, as you point out, between the Jews and the Catholics. And Kennedy power was waning, and whose power was going to supplant what used to be Catholic power. And that was the fight. And as it turns out, Rahm Emanuel assumed the mantle and made it very clear who was going to win. And so that's how you get a Congress now that 535 individuals, and you might have one or two, maybe after these elections, you might have three or four that will vote against any AIPAC-sponsored legislation. But whatever Israel wants, Israel gets. And basically, whether it's the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, they both have been taken over by the pro-Israel money. So now here's the question that I really have, because even as Dr. Jones points out that Marcus Garvey was railroaded, said that he was railroaded I don't have the exact quote, but it was, here it is right here. When they wanted to get me, they had a Jewish judge try me and a Jewish prosecutor. I would have been freed, but two Jews on the jury held out against me 10 hours and succeeded in convicting me, whereupon the Jewish judge gave me the maximum penalty. So now what is it that was so offensive that Marcus Garvey was doing besides instilling Black pride, which might have been offensive to a lot of people, not just the Jews, but what Marcus Garvey was also doing was planning this alliance, sort of this very same, as I'll say, coalition of we the people. So you get the whites, the laboring whites, the whites who were left behind by the quote unquote pilgrim elites. You forge a relationship with them, between them and the Blacks. And that, of course, I believe is the ultimate expression for we the people. And that is the one that is consistently fought. If you have Dr. Jeff Perry, who researches Hubert Harrison and the making of the white race, the invention of the white race, and basically he says that when that possible coalition of we the people came together was exactly when you had the creation of the white race. So the question that I have is it possible for we the people to be an inclusive we the people in order to take the back control of the US? And as the question was posed to me, how can I be assured that after we are able to come together, that the same thing won't be done to Black people all over again by those people who were supporters of Jim Crow segregation and the whole thing? And I don't have an answer for that. So what I'm really trying to understand is the readiness and the willingness of the left behind white community to join with the left behinds of other communities and approach each other on equal basis. Is that something that's possible?
Yeah, I can't
understand Dr. Jones. I'm having problem understanding.
I think it was temporarily your feedback. Do you have headphones on, Cynthia?
Okay. No, if I need to put some headphones on, I can do that.
Yeah, would you mind doing that while Dr. Jones responds?
Okay, I certainly will.
Okay. The first question, why did the NAACP turn against Marcus Garvey? The NAACP at this point had a Black front man, W.E.B. Du Bois, who was a communist. But it was run by two Jews, the Spingarn brothers, who had a big role in the creation of the Harlem Renaissance. Okay, why did they turn on Marcus Garvey? Well, because Marcus Garvey was proposing a kind of Black, pan-Black ethnic nationalism for the Black people. And that did not fit into the Jewish program. The Jewish program for Black people has always been integration. Now, everyone says, well, what's wrong with integration? Well, the flip side of integration is basically the lack of any type of ethnic solidarity. The Blacks are an ethnic group in this country. They do divide down between Catholic and Protestant, but they do constitute an ethnic group, especially in the South. Okay, the whole point of the Jewish strategy here at the NAACP was to deny them their ethnic solidarity and make them the goal for their lives, integration, which means the dissipation of their political power. That's what happened, okay, over this period of time. No one talks about Marcus Garvey anymore. Nobody even knows who he is anymore, okay? Second point is that we did do this with the show that I do with Peter Helland. There was a statue in South Bend, Indiana, a new statue, Father Hesburgh and Martin Luther King. It's based on a famous photograph where Father Hesburgh went up to Chicago because Martin Luther King was there. He was in trouble. He needed some type of support. And so they were up there and they're singing, "We Shall Overcome." Well, what was Father Hesburgh doing? Father Hesburgh was turning on the Catholics. He was betraying the Catholics whose neighborhoods were being attacked by this so-called integration movement. Okay, so we did a show in South Bend, and we came, two black guys, two white guys, me and Peter Allen. Mario Sims had grown up in Chicago, and we all came to the conclusion that this was a monument to social engineering. That's what was going on here. This was the social engineering of the Chicago, of the neighborhoods in Chicago, and the black people were proxy warriors for other people that no one knew about at that point. So at this point, when you expose this, you suddenly realize it wasn't a black-white conflict. It was a Protestant-Catholic-Jew conflict in which the blacks got dragooned into serving as the proxy warriors for the elite group in the country. At that point, I think you can start talking about what people have in common, which is basically economic interest. The whole hope here in Indiana in voting for Trump was that the focus would be on economic interest. The only time he got a standing ovation was when he talked about Carrier Air Conditioning moving its plant to Mexico. So the people of Indiana, no matter what they are otherwise, voted for their economic interest at this point, and that's why Donald Trump is in office. Now, as soon as he gets in office, we suddenly realize he's got all of this baggage with him that he owes to the Jews. And so we now have a foreign policy that's Israel first instead of in contradiction to the domestic policy, which is supposed to be America first. But I think if the answer is it possible? Yes, it's possible, but only if people start to understand where this black-white conflict came from. And who was orchestrating it?
Great point. So real quick, I'm going to read a couple. We have a couple donation questions that we're going to ask. And we've been going about 45 minutes. How are you on time, Dr. Jones? Are you good to keep going?
Yes, I'm here. I have an hour allotted for this.
So okay, great. So we'll get through this and we'll do a couple final questions. Quantrell Bishop, $5. What is E. Michael Jones's view on gambling, particularly the major push for sports gambling? Many of my peers are literally degenerates, gambling on sports they don't even watch and often have nothing else to talk about. I'm a college student. This is a disturbing trend.
Gambling should be illegal because there are certain people who simply cannot resist it. The roots of gambling are Jewish in this country. Okay, I did this in a book I did on Cincinnati, which focused on Newport, Kentucky, which was Sin City across from Cincinnati. Before gambling was legal, Cincinnati had gambling, and it was Mo Dalitz and the Jewish Navy, and it was Meyer Lansky. Okay, they got driven out of town by a Catholic who became a sheriff, and Mo Dalitz went to Las Vegas, and that became the Jewish gambling capital of the world. Our foreign policy, the main reason we don't have a treaty with Iran on nuclear weapons is Sheldon Adelson, who owns casinos in Las Vegas and elsewhere. This has accumulated so much money in Jewish hands that they can buy any politician they want. And so therefore, the first step to stopping or thwarting Jewish power in this country is stopping legalized gambling.
Next question from Richard Wilson, $5. How influential was Jacob Frank? I think he's the Messiah from some Polish guy from the 18th century, a Jewish Messiah. Are you familiar with him?
Yes.
Dr. Jones?
Yes, not as influential as Shabbatai Zvi. Shabbatai Zvi led, Frank was supposed to be a follower of Shabbatai Zvi, who was the Jewish Messiah in the 16th century. Every Jew, every Jewish congregation in Europe recognized him as the Messiah. They went to Turkey where he lived, and at this point he became a Muslim. He converted to Islam because the caliph gave him the choice of conversion or having his archers shoot arrows at him. So at this point, the Jewish Messiah became a Muslim and set off a cataclysm throughout the Jewish world, which led to the basically splitting up of Jews into either the Hasids, who were basically pietists who simply withdrew from any type of contact with the world, and the Maskalim, the enlightened Jews who became the Russian revolutionaries and led to Bolshevism and beyond.
Okay, so in our last 15 minutes, I guess the topic I really want to get to is some of the contemporary issues related to your comments. I've seen before, Mr. Jones, as you've talked about the two parties, the Republicans being the party of usury and the Democrats being the party of sodomy. And do you see that to be the case? I mean, that to me, it strikes me as true that that has been the paradigm, you know, at least up until Donald Trump. Has he done anything to change that? Is there any hope to change that? What is your view?
Trump's domestic policies have had an effect. I was in Granite City, Illinois. U.S. Steel opened up a plant there. They have had an effect in the contracting the labor supply. If you contract the labor supply by keeping out illegal immigrants, wages will rise. The whole point of the oligarchist strategy here with wages is to flood the country with immigrants to drive wages down. That's the whole strategy behind feminism as well. Double the workforce, half wages. That's the issue. So jobs are coming back, but the problem here is that wages are way too low. We have an objective criterion of what wages have to be. The objective criterion is the family wage, which is basically a man needs to earn enough to support a family so that his wife can stay home and take care of the kids. That is the objective bottom floor of wages, and we have to come around to some type of understanding of that, either through subsidy, government subsidy, or simply penalizing, removing the subsidies from people like Walmart, who get subsidized to keep wages low because of the benefits the government gives to their employees. That's the crucial factor. Whether Trump is in a tragic situation, he's captured by the Jews for some reason or other, probably because of the money they lent him when he was going into bankruptcy. The question is whether he can extricate this America first policy, domestic policy, from the Israel first foreign policy and end this kind of schizophrenia.
There's a question in the chat. They'd like to know what your view of Paul Krugman is, Dr. Jones.
Paul Krugman, I used to like listening to them, but Paul Krugman, when he went to Iceland, like the Icelanders, when they went bankrupt, or when their banks collapsed, they invited Paul Krugman to there. And what did Paul Krugman tell him? Pay off your debts. Take responsibility for those debts. Well, what are you talking about? 500,000 people who catch fish for a living paying off billions of dollars of bad debt? No, yeah. There was bad advice. When push came to shove, all Paul Krugman did was represent the interests of the Wall Street bankers. And he covered himself in shame, as far as I'm concerned. And to their credit, the Vikings in Iceland did not listen to him. And they stiffed the international markets. And they let them default on their debts. And the markets are coming back to them, begging them now to borrow money again. This is what Ireland should have done. And the Irish were too stupid to do it.
Well, I'll start with Dr. McKinney on this question. Is this something that America should consider? I mean, it seems to have the noose of, you know, whether it's what we know of the $20 trillion or it's probably $30 trillion by now debt on the U.S. federal government, the state debt, the private debt, the pensions. I mean, just all the liabilities that we have in this country. are we better off defaulting all this, basically telling our creditors to shove it?
Well, it depends on which creditors you're talking about, but certainly if you're talking about the Federal Reserve, I would say that we don't owe them a thing and shouldn't pay another dime. I have a question that reflects some of my concerns. I have actually two questions. One for Dr. Jones is, do you feel that the Soros involvement in the domestic side of the 2018 elections is a cause for concern? And then the second question I have is about the Zionists that are split into two factions that constitute the U.S. deep state that's now fighting each other, and it's just two Zionist factions. What are your thoughts on those two points?
Cynthia, we almost met in Iran at the Black Lives Matter conference. You were scheduled to be there. Unfortunately, you didn't come. Okay, I sat in the audience there. I was supposed to give a talk, and there was one message that I was going to give about Black Lives Matter, and that was namely George Soros gave Black Lives Matter $33 million. Now, why did they do that? Why did he do that? Because he wants to reignite race war in the United States of America. And he succeeded in place in Missouri to a large extent. Okay. That is, I was unable to make that point. Okay. The point I'm trying to make here is that why is he interested in doing that? Because as soon as black start fighting white, the Jew disappears. As soon as you start talking about white people, the Jew disappears. Okay, and once the Jew disappears, you don't know what he's doing, and you can't hold him accountable for what he's doing. So to get back to George Soros, yes, he was behind that whole thing, and he should be held accountable for it. What's the second question?
The second question was about the Zionists having been split now into two factions fighting
yes.
each other.
And they are fighting each other. So Obama manipulated the J Street faction, the J Street Jews, supported Obama. So Trump comes into office, and since he doesn't like Obama, he has to go over to the Likudnik Jews, okay? And he's got to support them. So we're caught in a civil war between two groups of Jews. Why can't we just say, wait a minute, I don't want to be in this. Why is the United States in the middle of a civil war between two groups of Jews? There's a message here. They've got too much political power. If one faction or the other faction is constantly controlling American foreign policy.
Okay, the final thing I want to say, and I'm sorry to be taking, but this is a treat for me to be with Dr. Jones.
Oh, of course, take anything.
Okay, the final thing that I want to say is, it seems to me that divide and rule is always used as a tactic because it works. And if the only way that we in the United States are going to be able to defeat the deep state, to defeat divide and rule, is for we the people to actually mean all of us, we the people, coming together. And that's what I would like to work with you, Dr. Jones, on trying to make happen.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's been an honor to be on this program with you. And I hope we can get together and work together.
Thank you.
So Dr. Jones, we're almost at an hour mark. I want to give my co-host Vivian a chance to she's had a question she wanted to ask you. Vivian, why don't you go ahead and ask, and then we'll bid Dr. Jones adieu.
Yeah. Do you think that it's possible that the the strength of the Israel lobby will fade, like, as the US becomes has more demographic replacement, that type of thing?
Look, I had great hopes for the Mexican immigration because most Mexicans are Catholic. We have a ferocious engine of social engineering that operates on everyone throughout the world, and certainly everyone that comes into the United States as a citizen. Everyone who comes here wants to succeed according to the rules of the United States. So I don't have any great real hope on just ethnic numbers. It doesn't work. You have to have consciousness If you have consciousness and numbers, then you can have some type of effect. But the problem is the consciousness is being deliberately and ruthlessly suppressed here.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. E. Michael Jones, for coming on. Dr. McKinney, I don't know if I had, if you're able to stay a little bit longer, if you need to go as well, it's up to you. But yes, Dr. Jones, it's been a great honor. I've ordered your book. I know it's a large one. It'd probably take me a while to read, but I'm excited to get started. And then some of your newer ones, Barren Metal. And you have a new book coming out as well, correct, sir?
Yeah, I'm working on the history of Logos and the Logos of history. It's about Logos. One word. Book on one word. Greek word on reason.
Well, hopefully you enjoyed your time here. I would love to have you back maybe in a couple of months to talk about that book and to talk about the concept of Logos. It's something that, like I think you've said many times, it's not a word that has any correlate in the English language and is a bit of a difficult subject to get one's mind around, and I would love to hear more about it from you. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you, Dr. Jones, and I'll be contacting you shortly.
Good. Thank you.
It just seems to go on and on. I'm in the middle of exams right now.
Peace.
Bye.